Bhagavataya Pratibhutikam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Kratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvamanu Santadhami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini. Chapter 18, verse 66. Sarvadharman parityajya, sarvadharman parityajya, mamekam sharanam vraja, mamekam sharanam vraja, ahantva sarva papebhyah, ahantva sarva papebhyah, mokshayishyami mashuchah, mokshayishyami mashuchah. Sarva dharman parityajya mam ekam sharanam vraja aham tva sarva papebhyah mokshayishyami ma shuchah. Sarva dharman parityajya, having abandoned, having given up. Tyaj means to abandon, to renounce. Pari means completely. Right? So if I say parijnanam, that means knowledge that is complete, where you have something. They use an example for pari. If you have something like they use the example of an amalaka fruit. It's a little round, small little fruit like this. If you put it in the palm of your hand, you can see all the way around it. You can kind of visualize, see it from all sides because it's small enough for you to see the whole thing. So that's parijnanam. It means you have a thorough grasp of it. Here, that pari is used in reference to tyaj, to renounce, to abandon, to give up. So having completely renounced sarva dharman, all dharma, mam ekam sharanam vraja, may you take sharanam. When you say sharana, this word sharanam means like refuge, and it usually goes with a verb like gam gach, a verb to go, like vraj or gach. So vraja means may you take refuge, means may you go to sharanam, may you go under my protection. But in English we just say may you take refuge. Mam ekam, with me alone. Mam means me, ekam. So may you take refuge with me alone, having given up sarva dharman, all dharma, all the dharmas. Aham twa, aham means I, twa means you, in the accusative singular, twa is a secondary form of twam. So accusative singular, so I, you, sarva papebhyaha, from all papas, punya papa. So they just choose papa because those are the ones we're really concerned about. Okay, So moksha yishami, aham moksha yishami, I will liberate you. Aham I, moksha yishami, that's a future, I will liberate twa, you, sarva papebhyaha, from all papa, from all sins. So then he says, ma shuchaha, may you not, don't grieve. Okay, so this is the verse. Before I start unfolding it, I want to tell you a few things about this verse. This verse is really considered the last verse of the Gita. And so I think the Gita goes to like verse 70, 73 or 74, something like that. But in any case, whatever it is, let me see. I'm just curious now. 78, okay, so we're going to have another 10 verses. But those
78,
12. Yeah, 78. But those verses are all praise. Praise to the student, praise to the teacher, who the Gita should be taught to, and how the teacher should be, the blessings that just even reading the Gita gives to the student. So it's all different types of praise, which is part of the tradition. Usually at the beginning of a text, there will be prayers to Bhagawan, and then prayers, and then praise to the student, praise to the teacher. The teacher, the one who's writing the text, will often say why they're writing it, all of this type of thing. And then at the end, there will be verses that say that, now if you really study this text well, you know, you will receive, you know, limitless punya, or it will bless you in so many different ways, or if you study this with shraddha, you will gain moksha. So just give some kind of enthusiasm and shraddha. It helps to build the shraddha in the mind of the student so that they can take the text seriously and take it with reverence. Because actually, in terms of the Vedanta is a pramana, is a means of knowledge. It's words that are passing from the mind of the teacher to the mind of the student. The vision of the teacher is passing through words to the mind of the student. Right? That's what's happening. So there's something through the use of words that have to transmit, as though I don't like that kind of language, but in a sense, the teacher is transmitting the vision that he or she is holding, that is held in the Upanishads, to the mind of the student. So that the vritti that's taking place in the mind of the teacher needs to be the same, right? But, you know, that really can't happen. That type of transmission, it's like lighting, an example they use is like having one candle flame lighting another candle flame. So those candle flames are the same then. So what the teacher has a vision that's being given over to the student, and that's very possible to do because there in truth, there's only one self. And so it's not like trying to create another self, you know. And the mind also, vritti. Sukshma, the vritti itself is very pliable, and it's pointing to, the teaching is pointing out to something that is actually there to be recognized. And so that transmission is very possible if the teacher isn't and the student aren't in each other's way. You know, like that's why, you know, we always do these shantipathas, like Sahanavavatu, all of these prayers. We always have these prayers that we do that are praying, really, that both the teacher and the student can get out of the way, that there isn't any ahankara or any hurt feelings or any, you know, dislikes or anything like that in the way, so that this knowledge has kind of a free pass, in a way. And that requires certain attitudes on the part of both teacher and student in order for the knowledge really to take place. And so you'll see when we get to these 10 verses or so, that's exactly what Krishna is talking about, how to create the shraddha and the situation and the attitude that is necessary for this knowledge to take place. And then he even says, you know, if that isn't there, then it shouldn't be taught. It shouldn't be taught because it's not going to work, right? And so then the blessing of it is not going to happen. So it's very, very beautiful, and it's he really goes into some depth. I mean, 10 or more verses in the Gita, you know. But I just want you to know that how much a part of the whole tradition it is, you know. So you'll find it in all of the Upanishads and most of these Prakarana Granthas like Atma Bodha and Aparoksha Anubhuti and different texts that we're going to be taking. This is always there. And you can also, even when I was reading it, you know, I was going ahead from studying this verse, I was going ahead and reading it, and it was making me feel really good. Because there's so much, you know, the verses make you feel like, okay, I'm really being blessed by this, and everything is going to be fine, and Bhagawan will take care of everything. You know, just because you have shraddha, if you have shraddha in the text, and you have shraddha in the teacher and in the teaching, everything will be fine, and you're blessed, all is well. And so I was just noticing, wow, that really, really works. Because Because they're talking about you, you know? They're talking about you, and they think, oh, okay, everything's really good. Okay. So, anyway, to get back to where we are, this verse, Sarva Dharman Parityaja, you know, usually before we eat a meal, we'll chant all of the chapter 15 of the Bhagavad Gita, and then we'll chant the Brahmarpanam Brahmahavihi, and then we'll chant this, Sarva Dharman. It's a beautiful verse to memorize because it so really contains the vision so much, and it contains all of kind of a attitude, the karma yoga attitude, and also the fruits of your knowledge are in this verse. So you can see it's attitudinal because he says, may you seek refuge in me alone. Right? That's an attitude. So sarva dharman parityaja, having given up sarva dharma, all dharma. So now if I say all dharma, that includes a dharma, right? So it means having given up all action and the results of all action. Having given all up all of that, take your refuge in me alone. So the me alone is in me, Ishwara. So Krishna is talking as Ishwara, because Krishna is Ishwara, right? Sometimes Krishna is talking as Krishna, Arjuna's friend, you know, friend and mentor, and is taking his own physical form. Sometimes he's talking about himself as Ishwara, because Krishna is an avatar of Ishwara. So he's talking from the standpoint of Ishwara. Sometimes he's talking just from the standpoint of the Atma, I am you, you know. And so here, when he says, take your refuge in me, you know, having given up all dharma. So now, to give up all dharma, another way of saying that is having renounced, having given up all karma and all the results of karma, dharma and adharma. Right? Because everybody, it's not as though we're all perfect beings and there's no adharma. Right? There's dharma and adharma. We have, you know, the sanchita karma, all of the karmas that have brought you the infinite number of karmas. And out of that sanchita karma, you have this prarabdha karma, the karma that you're living through now, this birth. That is an infinite. So you have infinite number of karmas and the results of karma in the form of punya and papa in that sanchitta. And this minuscule, it's almost like the size of the universe. Your experience of the universe is very minuscule in time and space compared to the size of the universe. We can say, your little piece of this little prarabdha karma, compared to the sanchitta karma that you have, is so minuscule, because the sanchitta karma is as beginningless as the creation, you know. So there is no first birth for you. There is no birth, in fact. That's, you have to come to the Mandukya Upanishad to really appreciate that. There, in reality, there is no birth, because for what actually is, there is no birth. There is no coming into being of Brahman, coming into being of yourself, and there's no going out of being. So this being that you are, this me, this very personal me that you are, it has no birth or death. It's simply, the me that you are simply is, free from time, free from change. The me, the transmigrating jiva, you know, we say it is beginningless, but once you say that it's beginningless, then it's free of any type of birth, really, because as we're seeing in the Mandukya Upanishad, every effect, right, has a cause, and that cause itself was an effect of a prior cause. So this is, if it's too much for you, don't worry about it, but just to kind of recap what we're doing in the Gita, what that actually means is that there is no cause and effect, right, because every effect is a cause, and every cause is an effect. And so in that sense, there, it's like chicken and egg, what comes first? And so when you start analyzing that, there really is no beginning, so there really is no coming into being in any real sense, like coming into being from something that actually is, because the thing that actually is isn't. It's only an effect of something that itself was at one time an effect. And so you can't get to any type of substance in terms of the beginninglessness of the creation or the beginninglessness of your life, of yourself as a jiva taking birth after birth after birth. But if within this time-space world that we're experiencing right now, like with our eyes and sense organs and with our organs of action, here we are experiencing this world, and experiencing within this world that we find ourselves in, like a dream character within the dream world, we are continually accruing karma, right? We are doing an action and reaping the results of that action. So within the reality, the what we call empirical reality of this creation we find ourselves in, we're continually accruing karma, and according to the Shastra, those actions are twofold. The results of the actions that we accrue are twofold. One is called drishta, means we're doing an action, and we are, by the very fact that we're doing the action, we're experiencing a result to that action here itself. You know, it might be a little bit prolonged, but here itself, we're experiencing the result of our actions. But according to the Shastra, we're also accruing subtle results that are called adrishta. And those subtle results are what we call punya and papa. Some actions that take place within dharma will give punya. Actions that take place that are adharmic in nature will give papa. And that punya and papa is something that needs to be experienced later. That punya and papa is adrishta. It's not seen here and now. Right? And so that goes into what we call the sanchitta. And the sanchitta, at the moment of your death, when you're taking and ready to take the next birth, at that moment of death, you will accrue from the sanchitta karmas that will take you through, which are in the form of punya and papa, those results that will take you through this particular life. And it goes on like that. Okay? So this is a little extra explanation to this metaphor I was using. But, you know, just like here, at this moment in time, at this place of time, you are not even a bleep on the screen in reference to the whole creation. Right? Even in terms of time and space, we might say you're invisible. We'd have to get at a microscope, some sort of a huge microscope to try to to and just in that second of time, mini second of time, just to be able to experience this life in reference to the whole creation. Well, think of your karmas like that. The sanchitta karma, punya and papa. How much karma there is in your account. Right? And you're going on accruing it. Right? You're going on accruing karma by all of the actions in the prarabdha karma. They're called agami karmas, the karmas that you're accruing. So, there's a problem here. If you were to think that somehow to become free of karma, you need to exhaust your karma. In order to become free of karma now, that's going to be a big job, you know. It's a big job. It's a ridiculous job. There's no possibility. There's no possibility of exhausting your karma. So the fact is that you either are by your nature free of karma, or you're always going to be bound by karma, right? Because the number of karmas in your account are limitless. And also, to the degree that you take yourself to be a karta, means a doer. So if you take yourself to be a doer, you will be accruing karma, or you will be acting just by the mere fact that your nature is one of being a doer. That we call in Sanskrit, we call it a karta. Now we can even say like this. By the mere fact of having this body, your eyes are blinking. You can't stop your eyes from blinking. You can't stop your ears from hearing, you know. You are speaking, you're breathing, blood is flowing through your system. So the whole body, like it or not, is full of activity. Right? So Shankara will go on about this, the text will go on. The idea is this. If you take yourself to be a jiva, with a body, mind, sense organs. Everything about this organism is bound by karma. You can't stop karma. Even if you say, no, I'm just going to sit still here. You are doing the action of sitting still. There's verses in the Bhagavad Gita about this. You're actually doing a karma by sitting still. Say you say, I'm not going to blink. By not blinking, you're now doing the act of not blinking, which takes quite a bit of concentration, you know, to not blink, right? So the idea of being free from karma or renouncing karma is an impossibility if you take yourself to be a karta. You see what I mean? There's no possibility of that. And so we say that the only one who can be free of karma is the one who realizes, I am free of karma. That my nature as the self, the Atma, the truth of the whole creation, in fact, the very nature of my being, is free from karma. So I as the Atma, as the conscious being, for me, there is no karma. For me, there are no hands, there are no feet, there are no blinking eyes, there are no ears, there's no vak, there's no body, there's no sukshma sharira, no subtle body. All of these, what the upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs, belongs to the creation. It belongs to Maya. It's like if you think about the dream, and you are identified in the dream with a dream character, okay? That dream character can never be free of karma. You know, because everything about the dream character is full of rajas. It's true. But by its very nature, it's in continual activity. So the dream character, what is it going to do to realize that it is akarta, it is free from karma? There's nothing about it that's free from karma other than the truth of itself. That's it. So then who does this body belong to? If I, by my nature, as the conscious being that I am by nature free of karma, that has staggering implications if you really think about it. That who, this me, that because of self-ignorance, I have identified me, this conscious being, with this body, mind, sense organs. And so then my free will and my decisions and my actions, all of these things, right, are things that I am doing. Because I'm thinking, I'm feeling, I'm making decisions. I'm walking, I'm talking, all of these things are things that I am doing. Actually, they're not things that I am doing. They're things that this body is doing, that this mind is doing, that my sense organs are doing, that my buddhi is doing. Okay? Not me. I'm not doing anything. And I've never done anything. Just as conscious being, I am always exactly the same. As conscious being, I'm not even a knower. I am the conscious being that is self-evident me, which the mind which enjoys knowership from its own standpoint, right? But the knowership that the mind enjoys is dependent on conscious being, but conscious being is not a knower. The thinker, the decider, the dharmi, the adharmi, right? These belong to the body, mind, sense organs, not to me. And even from my standpoint, I don't even know about it. From the standpoint of me as conscious being, I don't know about that. I know about it from the standpoint of this upadhi. But from the standpoint of me, I am not a knower. This may sound a little strange to you, but I'll tell you, this is why sometimes, and maybe we should spend a lot more time on it too, is doing japa, the repetition of a mantra, you know. When you do the repetition of a mantra, what happens is you start to realize, it becomes very self-evident that the mantra is rising and setting. Like Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya. When you do that, you start to get just naturally a distance between, as though distance, a viveka, a discrimination between your own self-evident me, your presence, and the mantra. And you notice that even though the mantra is known, as it rises and sets, you're not doing anything. That there's no knowership on your part. Even though the mantra is known. No knowership, nothing on your part, except just self-evident meanness. So you actually are not a doer, you're not a thinker, you're not a feeler, you're not a knower. You just are your being, the being that is you, which is full and whole and complete in itself, and is the very being from which the whole universe comes. But from its own standpoint, I simply am, without doership, without knowership, but I am, as conscious being, self-evident. Not self-evident because somebody is knowing me, but because I am conscious being itself. But I am not a doer or a knower from my own being. And this being that I am is Brahman. This being that I am is the being that you are, is the being that you are, is the being that all animals are, is the being that all plants are, is the very being, you know, from which the whole universe comes. Like the dream. You are a being, if you're identified with a character in a dream, you are the one from whom the whole dream comes, which includes the character in that dream. Right? So the whole dream, including the character in the dream, enjoys your being, but from the standpoint of you, you're not doing anything. You simply are. But the dream character and all of the dream characters and the whole dream itself enjoys your existence and the consciousness, the conscious being that you are. It all enjoys that completely. Right? But from your standpoint, you're not doing anything or knowing anything. You're just self-evident me. So now to circle back, who does this body, mind, sense organs belong to? You have to say, well, it belongs to the whole dream. It's part of the dream. It's part of the dream story. It belongs to Ishwara. It is like a cell in Ishwara's body. You know? And so, because this cell in Ishwara's body has free will, you know, it can rub up against, it's still a cell in Ishwara's body, but it has certain capacities and it can rub up against the prarabdha, which is this part of Ishwara that this body, mind, sense organs is enjoying. You know, imagine again the dream, okay? The dream character that you're identified within the dream is enjoying a stream of experience. It enjoys a stream of experience, right? Here in this infinite creation, you, in this the prarabdha karma, the karmas that, you know, are manifesting for you, means that you have a stream of experience. You are located in a stream of experience, which you are enjoying through your sense organs, right? And you can butt up against that, you know, and create dharma and adharma, create rifts and all kinds of things. But they're all totally controlled, in a sense, by the laws of the creation, the laws of Ishwara, and the laws that are taking place within the stream that you're experiencing. You can't get yourself out of that stream of laws. But here, you know how I'm saying you can't get yourself? That's all from the standpoint of the upadhi, the body-mind sense organs that belong to Ishwara. You're not doing anything. And so thinking of that, what he says is, so having given up all dharma and adharma, means giving up all karma, take refuge in me alone. Take refuge in me alone means recognize that this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara. And let Ishwara handle it. Your prarabdha karma, the prarabdha karma is Ishwara. Ishwara is the objective reality that this body, mind, sense organs finds itself in, the objective reality of this body. It's called vyavahara. This body is vyavahara. It's empirical shared reality. It is has joined the creation. It's not your subjective reality. And this body belongs to this creation. Okay. You have a mind. The mind is not pratibhasika. It's not subjective. What things can be subjective, but the mind itself, the buddhi, the mind, the instruments, your sense organs, your organs of action, this is all vyavahara. This is all Ishwara. It's not something that you can say, okay, I don't think I'll have a mind today. Let's imagine something else. No. The mind itself can think of all kinds of things subjectively, but the mind, what it thinks can be subjective, but the mind itself is objective. It's Ishwara. The prarabdha is Ishwara. So what it's saying is, you know, give up all of these karmas. They belong to me. Yeah. Take refuge in me itself. This is the whole karma yoga buddhi. It is what's natural. What is sadhana for a mumukshu is jnanam, is knowledge, is nishta for a jnani. For a jnani, to the degree that your vairagya has matured, and vairagya means that dispassion where the rag, you're not run by your raga dvesha, by your likes and dislikes. You know, what happens as you mature in your knowledge is that raga, dvesha, these likes and dislikes, which are in the template form, is I need this to be happy. I need this, you know, I need to get rid of this, this to be happy, that's dvesha. I need to get rid of this so that I can be happy. Raga is, I need to have this so that I can be happy. You can't believe, I mean, as you grow older in this knowledge, you can't believe the subtlety, how subtle these raga dveshas can be, you know? You know, how... it's an amazing thing, you know? But the more you mature, the more the subtle the raga dveshas become, because the grosser ones are you've let go, you know? But then you keep noticing, and as you notice, as you are owned... If your behavior is owned or committed to a given raga dvesha, the jiva is there. So that's the habitual ignorance. The jiva arises. Because I need this. If the raga dvesha is just a preference, I want this but not so that I can be happy. That's just the mithya. There's no problem. Because as long as you have jnanam, as we have self-knowledge, as long as you have this body, there's still going to be preferences and things that you're doing and things you're not doing. You're going toward this and away from that. But they're only preferences. So that you're actually free inside your buddhi. You're free to let Ishwara be. And to do your duty, whatever that is, that's what I do. Because it doesn't matter. It's like the graham crackers. I don't have to have the horse graham cracker. I mean, I can have any. I could have the hyena graham cracker. That's okay. It doesn't make any difference. Graham cracker is graham cracker. Brahman is Brahman. What is actually here is only one, me. And so I am absolutely free to be with this creation, which is to say, to be with Ishwara, to let Ishwara be. That's... He's just giving it to you right here, what you mature into with this knowledge. So he says, sarva dhanaman parityaja, having given up all dharma, mam ekam sharanam vraja, take refuge in me alone. Otherwise, what are you going to take refuge in? Samsara. That's Take refuge in me alone, or take refuge in me and samsara. Well, the part of refuge that you take in samsara is full of dukkha. So you won't be taking refuge in dukkha for very long. That's the thing. You'll switch over to another dukkha, and then to another dukkha. It's all, you know, it's like the Buddha said, every sukha is a womb for dukkha. You know, every happy moment is a womb for sorrow, because it's all time bound. That's just how it is. It's nobody's fault. It's just how it is. The Upanishads are telling you how to get out of this problem. So Krishna here is telling you in a very succinct, beautiful verse, what happens as you mature. So he says, you know, give up dharma and adharma, both, because neither is you. Neither karma, neither the good or the bad karmas are you, neither the punya and papa is you. It's not saying, Swamiji says this in his commentary, now don't misunderstand, Shankara says also, don't misunderstand that you should think, okay, now I can do as much adharma as I want. I give up it all the adharma, all the papa doesn't make any difference. I'm just free to, no. It isn't like that at all. That's not what's being said. Recognize that your being is free of dharma and adharma, and take refuge, is free of all karma. And take your refuge in me. It means give this body over to the one who already owns it. Recognize the truth of that. And then he says, aham twa sarva pape bhiha mokshi ishami. Then I will liberate you from all papa. When he says from all, I will liberate you from all papa, he can say, well, say, I'll liberate you from all punya and all papa. But what he's really saying here, papa is what causes dukkha, right? The events that cause dukkha. I will liberate you from all suffering. Why? Because to whatever degree that you're attached in one way or another to this creation, there is suffering. And the creation also will make you suffer in terms of any type of papa. But if you take refuge in me, there is no punya or papa to worry about, because your being is now, your antakarana, your buddhi, is no longer behaving like a jiva, where my ananda has something to do with what happens out here. What about when my ananda, my wholeness, has nothing to do with what happens out here? What happens out here, out here means within duality, is Ishwara. So let Ishwara be. Let this body, mind, sense organs being taken care of by Ishwara. Let me respond to the best of my ability to what comes my way. There's even a verse in the Gita that says, Yadrichaya, whatever comes to me by chance means I'm not working for it. Whatever comes to me in terms of my prarabdha, whatever comes my way, then let me be satisfied with that. So here he says, doing this, I will liberate you from all papa. How will I liberate you? It's not that Bhagavan is going to come along and do something to liberate you. You, in fact, are already liberated. This is already how it is. So the liberation is only a liberation through knowledge, through recognizing the freedom and the wholeness of your own being, and recognizing that nothing is ever happening to you. That's why even with the kind of simple little meditation we did, that meditation, it's key. There's a key understanding in that meditation. And it is that your mind now is starting to differentiate between your own nature, which never changes at all, not at all, and all the experiences that are coming and going, whether your eyes are open or closed, whether your mind is peaceful or agitated, nothing is happening to you. And so all it takes on your part as a jiva, on the part of the mind, is to make that gentle shift of recognition. It's not like you have to control all of your thoughts, you know, or say, I can't have this emotion or this feeling, or I can't have this experience or that experience. Yes, you can. Your mind can have all kinds of experiences. But how are you with those experiences? If you make, just in the middle of whatever experience you're having, it doesn't matter what it is, whatever experience you're having that the sensory perceptions or that your mind is doing, just as a little sadhana, you just make the gentle shift to your own presence, not trying to change the experience at all. Don't bother about it, whatever it is. You just make that gentle shift, that noticing your own being. And in that moment of noticing yourself, then it becomes more dominant. You know? And that's all that's needed. It's just an easy, simple little shift. It's not a big deal. It's a recognition of the self that you've started to differentiate. And you just get used to doing that. You know, and there's all of these different sadhanas that we learn to try to help our mind and be a friend of the mind. These are all valuable, to talk to the little ones, you know, just to settle down all of the traumas. We have lifetimes of traumas, so there's ways of dealing with all of that. But just this learning, this recognition of the sanctity of your own being, and that nothing can happen to you, and nothing is ever changing in reference to yourself, that gives you, there's no doership there. There's no norship. Let Ishvara have all of that because it already belongs to Ishvara. Yeah. The dream analogy or the analogy of your imagination is really, really helpful. Because if you analyze your dream experience, you're the whole creation. You're not just the dream character in there. You're the whole thing. And that, when we talk about it in the dream, you say, yeah, that's right. I mean, that's obvious. Is the whole dream comes from you, that character is there, part and parcel of the whole. And so dream analogy is very important to contemplate on, because that's our situation here. This body, mind, sense organs is part and parcel of the whole Dharma, the whole infinite order of this infinite creation. It belongs to it, is contained by it, you know? The conscious being that is me, which this particular body, mind, sense organ enjoys, as well as all other body, mind, sense organs enjoy, you know, that me is timeless, is changeless, and is the me that I recognize as me right now. There's no other me. You're not recognizing any other me as you right now other than Brahman. There is no other me. The only problem is that we're dressing it with the body and mind and sense organs, putting all this stuff on it. And so now the I that is Brahman, that is very personal, but is the me that is only Brahman, you know, my mind takes to belong to its thoughts. So then me, Brahman, becomes happy and sad, and the body becomes as young and old and, you know, male and female and all of these type of differentiations. Countless differentiations. But that's all from the standpoint of these dresses. The me remains the same, you know? It's like the one that says, I am happy, but yesterday I was sad. Thank goodness I'm happy now. That me, right, is Brahman. The me that is you, that is Brahman. There's no other Brahman, right? And so what has to happen is that the ahankar, this I notion, that's so lodged in this body, mind, sense organs, has to be released so that it can go home. Or it's already home, but then it's got all of this baggage that it's mistakenly taking onto itself just because of self-ignorance, not because of reality. So when he says, you know, understand this, give up all karma, because he's already taught Arjuna, we're at the last verse, so he's taught him all. Give up all of the Dharma. Give it all up. Renounce it completely. Just surrender. You know, take refuge in me. You know? With that, I will liberate you from all papa. Ma suchaha. Don't grieve. There's nothing for you to worry about. Now this ma suchaha, it goes back to verse 11 of chapter 2, where he says, Arjuna, he says, you're grieving over that which doesn't deserve any grief. You know, those people, the people who are wise, they know that there is no, you know, there is no truth in this living and dying. There is no being born and dying. There's nothing for you to grieve about. You know? So give all of that up. So at the end, this Mahashuchaha. So now you can imagine, Krishna has been talking, you know. He's been teaching Arjuna for 2 or 3 hours with nonstop. Two or three hours to do this. And he started out with, there's no cause for grief. You're speaking like a wise man. Some of the things you're saying are so wise. But on the other hand, you know, you don't know what you're talking about. There is nothing for you to grieve. And so now he says this, after having done all of this teaching. Understand this, do this. There's no cause for your grief. Right? I will liberate you from all papas. You just need to recognize yourself. Your liberation from all papas is the recognition that you are free from all papas. That you are already free from all karma. That is your liberation. Right? But it's not just in your head. It's not intellectual. Your mind is totally involved, but it's not an intellectual understanding. It's a pramana. It's a recognition, what we call aparoksha. A direct, immediate recognition of the truth of yourself. The truth of yourself is that you are completely free from all karma, from all papa. That is your nature. And so we say that the person who is a sannyasi is not the person who has taken sannyasa or stayed with karma yoga. He stays as a karma yogi or he takes sannyasa like Arjuna so much wanted to do. The karma yogi and the sannyasi are seekers to gain this knowledge. Either one of them will become a sannyasi in the true sense of the word, which means sarva karma sannyasa, the one who has renounced all karma. That person is a sannyasi. You can live the life of a sannyasi where you're just in this sense just contemplating and studying the shastra, and living a very contemplative life. Or you can be gaining this knowledge within the world, neutralizing your raga dvesha. But in any case, in the end, whether you're within karma yoga or you're karma yogi who has become a sannyasi, you, as a jnani, you will become the one who has sarva karma sannyasa, the one who has renounced sarva karma, all karmas. The renunciation of all karmas is only knowledge. There is no renunciation of karma in the world. You're always going to be accruing punya papa or whatever. No. The renunciation of karma is jnanam, is self-knowledge, and that's what it is. And so he says, Mahasuchaha, remember everything I've taught you. Don't grieve. Now, for these next verses, he's really going to build Arjuna and all of us up in a very beautiful way. But Shankara, which we're not going to do, but I'm going to give it to you to read. There's a very long, all Sanskrit.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, it's beautiful. It'll take us a long time to do it, but I think it's something to definitely read. I'm going to get copies made. I don't have it yet. But you can read the synopsis. It's Shankara's synopsis of the whole Gita. And the Swamiji gave classes line by line of the synopsis and expanded on it. So it's very beautiful. I'm going to let you all do that on your own, and we'll just go to these last six or ten verses, whatever it is. But that synopsis is, it's just something, it's like something precious to have, because when you read it, it just puts the whole, everything that we've been doing for the last 7 years, 7 or 8 years, it puts it into, you know, it puts it in caps on a beautiful summation of it. So I'm going to get those made for next, I didn't realize you didn't have them, so I'll get it made, but we're going to just go on to verse 67 next time.
Okay. But we don't want to go through that, you know. We don't.
No. But it's good for you to have.
Yeah, yeah.
For you to study and to study over and over like that.
Do it at the farm.
Yeah. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahimahishaha gopramanebhyah shivamastu nityam loka samastha sukhino bhavantu kale varshatu parajanyah prithivi sasya shalini desho yam shobharahitah Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukkha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritam gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Sure. There's no cause for grief, and yet what would you say when there is grief, when somebody's having a profound grief, and a prolonged profound grief? How do you incorporate that into what we just were looking at?
Well, it depends on if that person's a mumukshu or not. Like, say if the person is just a regular person, and dharmic person in the world, who's had a tragedy, and they're grieving, then you want to be able to give comfort to that person. Okay? Now say that in relatively, because that's their reality. You don't want to say ma suchaha, don't grieve, you're Brahman. You'll say Brahman. Yeah. That doesn't make any sense. And they don't have that mumukshutva, right? But say for a person who's studying and who is a mumukshu and who is gaining this knowledge, right? Then there are still levels that you don't want to bypass, you know. So you have to take all of the different sadhanas that we teach for doing that inner child work, you know, for giving comfort to the parts that are hurting, you know, and all of that. So there's different levels that have to be taken care of. It's like I use the example, like if you break your arm, hopefully you're not going to say, oh, don't complain about your broken arm, for heaven's sake, you know. You're going to take care of the arm because it's causing pain. So when your mind is causing a lot of pain, you have to take care of it on the level that the pain is. And then taking care of it, then you can bring your mind back to your knowledge. You don't want to bypass because that doesn't work. You have to take care of the ones who are hurting on the level that they're hurting. And then as they settle down, then you can bring in a deeper layer of understanding.
Because there's some occasions where this grief could last a lifetime in a way, the one that's grieving.
if that's the case, then would, in light of this knowledge, there should be the buddhi inside has got to come into relationship with that, where it can understand that and hold it, and not itself always be overwhelmed by that grief. Like say, for instance, sometimes like I had two students that I'm thinking of in particular. One, had lost her child to suicide. Child had committed suicide. And that was, and he was 17 and 18, she wrote a whole dissertation on it, you know, and how to, let alone the loss of a child, these are probably the worst, you know, how to be able to hold that sorrow or suffering. Because it's not as though you forget, you know, or that hurt goes away. It can always, that grief can always be there, that sadness around it can always be there. But you become somebody who is much bigger than that sadness. Mm-hmm. And so you know how to honor it and live with it. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that, it's something that you can handle and you have some distance from. It's not.
Well, you'd say that about a yoni then. I mean, that's that position. I mean, it won't go away for a yoni either. I mean,
it not necessarily will. But you become much bigger than it. Mm. Just like a person who's, that this woman is not having anything to do with Vedanta or self-knowledge, and she had to come to a place in herself, you know, that could handle this, because it's not as though it's going to go away. I mean, I know one friend who lost their, gosh, like 30 years ago, their son died when he was just like 8 months old, 7 or 8 months old. And that has never left them. But it's also not dominant in their life. But the sorrow of it, or that missing, it's never going to go away. It's part of who they are. But it's not dominant at all.
But the effect is still there.
Well, the
affect.
The affect is there in a small way, not in an overwhelming way.
Yeah.
You don't forget. The things that have happened, you don't forget. You know, the things that have really hurt you, they can be there, but they're not dominant. That's the main, I think understanding that dominance is important. You know.
I have a small question. From our parnam that we chant before eating, seems like it has some kind of, like a little bit of a metaphor about eating.
Well, it's just really a way of saying it's really, the metaphor is about doing a ritual, and actually everything is being fed to Agni as a ritual.
Right, but you could kind of apply that to, like, the act of eating also.
Yes, and to all acts.
And to all acts. But yeah. I was just wondering if there was anything in this verse that was, like, about that, or if it's just an important verse. You know what I mean?
The similarity between the two is give everything up to me. Because then the Brahmarpana recognize everything as me. So in the first verse, the Brahmarpana, it means I am the arpana, means the utensil. I am the fire, I am the offering, the havis. I am the agni. I am the fire itself into which the offering is offered with the havis, you know. And then I'm also the one who offers it, right? And so the one who recognizes, let's start, says, Brahmarpanam Brahmahavihi, Brahmagnau, Brahmanahutam. So I'm it being offered itself. Then Brahmaivatenagantavyam, Brahmakarma Samadhinaha. So Brahmaivatenagantavyam, by him, Brahmaivatena Gantavyam. By him, Brahman alone is reached. That Brahma Karma Samadhina. By whom this has that Samadhi. Samadhi means, who has that absorption, has that recognition that all karma is Brahman. Mm-hmm. Brahma karma samadhina. And so there, what he's saying is that every action, everything that's involved in any type of action is Brahman alone. By the one who recognizes that, that one reaches Brahman. Not reaches in terms of distance, but reaches in terms of knowledge. And then in this one, the sarva dharman paricchaya, it means giving up all dharma. Means dharma and adharma. Take refuge in me alone, right? And then taking refuge in me alone, I will relieve you. I will liberate you from all papa.
So in a way, it kind of like completes the first one.
It
like
does.
They are kind of a set.
They're kind of a set,
yeah,
in giving everything over to Ishwara. Without leaving anything out. Yeah. Don't leave anything out. You have to give the whole jiva, has to be given over to Ishwara. And then you just enjoy being yourself.
Mm.
Which is ananda. Mm. See, it's not like, oh, you mean I'm just going to be there by myself. You're the very, very ananda that you seek. Everything that the jiva seeks in the world is who, in fact, you know, it's like the self is hidden in the seeker. What you're seeking is your own being. And so at some point, the mind recognizes that, it stays with what it's always been seeking and lets Ishwara be Ishwara.
Wow.
And there is no part of the jiva that is not Ishwara. The jiva is Ishwara. There's nothing that exists within duality, even the ajnanam, that is not Ishwara. Ishwara has no ajnanam. From the standpoint of Ishwara, the ajnanam is just maya. But from the standpoint of the jiva, because of limitation, that what is maya for Ishwara is it can be ajnanam for the jiva. Because the mind is limited, the sense organs are limited, so the knowledge is limited. For Ishwara, there is no identification with any given thing within the upadi, within the total upadi.
Mm.
So there's no limitation. You know, like if you have a dream, there is no limitation for you as the Ishwara of the dream, but there is a limitation for every jiva in the dream because of the limitations of their upadis, right? But from the Ishwara upadi, there's no limitation. It's another reason why the dream analogy is so important, because you can see you are both Ishwara and the jiva, or that the jiva is part and parcel of Ishwara, but the jiva's experience is going to be one of limitation, because limited sense organs and mind, where the dream as a whole, is there is no limitation, because there's no identification with any particular part. So think about that in terms of the whole universe. Whole universe and all of the different dimensions is just one infinite knowledge. Swamiji calls the universe as the manifestation of infinite knowledge, because the universe is viewed by the Shastra as cyclical. So when the universe is up, what is that? It's the manifestation of infinite knowledge. When you say that, then you start to realize that there is no real physical universe. See, we think this is physical. But in the dream character is saying this is physical. But actually, it's just knowledge. And knowledge can be viewed from sukshma or stula, means subtle or gross, but it's still not just knowledge.
Knowledge in the sense of awareness?
Well, why we like to use knowledge, like if I ask you right now to imagine an ocean scene, okay, there it is. That's a manifestation of knowledge.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You were talking about the wound on the arm, and
yeah,
not just saying, you know, it's okay. But if we take the, you know, identify with the jiva to deal with the arm, then we're almost shooting ourselves in the foot from the beginning?
No.
Like there's no liberation, you know what I'm getting at? Like if you go to, like if you back up and see first that this isn't, like you see the whole picture before you go into the detail, then there's, I don't know how to use your language.
Okay, now that's okay. I'm trying to follow what you're saying, though. But what if you look at it like this? In this room, for mm-hmm. instance, not just your body, somebody else's body. Say somebody falls down and hurts themselves. Okay? Would you say, well, actually, it's all just mitya, and there's no, it's not appropriate for me to come and help? I doubt it. I think that what's being called upon you for you within the scope of that situation, you would spontaneously go to help, right? That's what would be natural.
The line and that, to draw is whether I'm doing it to make myself happy or to be an automatic, you know, the act of Ishwara. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, there's a line to draw if I'm just acting as an expression of...
Yeah, there is a line to draw there. Let me put it this way. Dharma itself, there's a natural happiness. In other words, the core of your being is full and complete, whether you know it or not, okay? It's not about knowledge. It's just about your essential nature. And so when your mind is living within Dharma, and it can go in and out too, but say when it's living within Dharma, there is a natural shanti, and so there's a natural peace that takes place in the mind. Because there's no non-conflict going on, and so the mind is enjoying a certain amount of subtlety, a certain amount of shanti that allows for a sense of well-being. When you go outside of Dharma, you know, there's a tension that takes place that takes away that sense of well-being. So even in the world, as you're, you know, satisfying your desires and whatnot, as long as they're within Dharma, there's no conflict, unless the desire is such that if you don't get your way, you become really unhappy, right? That's what we mean by raga dvesha. And so say within your environment, you are going to have preferences just because you're a human being. But the satisfaction or non-satisfaction of a given desire is not that big of a deal. It's all mitya. It doesn't matter. Then it's just a question of what are you, as just as a jiva within Ishwara, being called upon to do in a given situation? What is the natural response? What is Ishwara's response in a given situation? Now say if the overarching understanding of Dharma is ahimsa, non-injury, you know, or do unto others, and under that do unto others as you would have done to yourself. Then in a given situation, if somebody falls and hurts themselves, it is natural for you to run up and try to help. There has to be something interfering, like maybe you're late for a date or something that's more important to you than that this person has fallen, so you kind of just push them out of your way and go, whatever. That is going to give some conflict. But what's natural is to go and help that person. It's your duty. It's natural to the creation. So that's in reference to another person. Now say you've broken your arm. What is natural is to go and help the arm, because the arm is hurt. And so it's not just because it's your arm, the arm is hurt, right? And so it's natural to go and help it. It's the same as when the mind is hurt. It is the natural response to help it. The problem is that we have a better understanding of how to help the arm than we have in how to help the mind. Yeah. Are either my mind or your mind or others' mind also. And that requires some learning and some understanding. And Vedanta actually, psychology is very good at this also. It has a lot to say about all of this, but Vedanta has even more to say about how to be in with that mind that is hurting in a way that on the many different levels is healing. And ultimately, the level of knowing your own being is the level that you're going to end up on, but there's also in between levels that are helpful. You know, I don't know if that helps, yeah. But you know, kind of getting around, working around there.
It's just so habitual.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Yes, we even call it habitual ignorance, because you start to gain an understanding, but your mind is still acting as though it doesn't know, and then you bring your mind back. you know, to the knowledge that you have. But you also shouldn't bypass. Bypassing is a problem, because then you have all of this stress and stuff inside that you're not acknowledging or taking place or taking care of on the level that the problem exists, you know. We have to take care of things on the level that they are hurting.
Can you make a distinction between Brahman and Ishwar? What's the proper way of looking at that?
The distinction
between those two words, Brahman
and
Ishwara. Yeah.
We can say, when I say Brahman, I'm just talking about the Satchit Ananda, the nature of the self. When I'm saying Ishwara, I'm acknowledging the Maya Upadhi.
Yeah.
That's all. That's the only difference.
That's
so in as a jnani, sometimes with somebody else, sometimes you have to be able to say, I am Ishwara. Because if you say, I am Ishwara, you're acknowledging this body, mind, sense organs, everything that about this jiva belongs to Ishwara, that Ishwara is mithya in the sense that the truth of Ishwara is Brahman. So if you can say, I am Ishwara, then this body, mind, sense organs has to be given over to Ishwara, because there's no way that your body, mind, sense organs can be Ishwara. It has to be part of Ishwara. Like the wave is part of the ocean. So now if I say, I am Ishwara, I have to be talking about myself as Brahman, which is the truth of Ishwara. Right? And so to say I am Ishwara is to have this knowledge completely. And to if you know what you're talking about when you say it, of course.
That confused me.
Well, let me go through all of them.
I thought I am Ishwara. Basically, you're saying I'm everything.
Yes. That's what you're saying. That's it. Because Ishwara is everything, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It's nice that this last significant, you know, real substantive teaching versus basically Tattvam Asi, right?
Yeah,
that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's it.
That's the Mahavakya. The whole Vedanta is in the Mahavakya. Well, there's Tattvam Asi, you are that, right? Aham Brahmasmi, I am Brahman. Prajnanam Brahma, Brahman is consciousness. I am Atma. I am Atma means I am Atma Brahman. This Atma is Brahman.
You know,
there's more too, but
yeah. That seems
it's
to
all
be
about identity.
Relatively easy to recognize to say Aham Brahmasmi, but to say Ishwara seems to be more challenging or more difficult.
It is more challenging in that it's more complete. Just to say I am Brahman, somehow if you say, I am Brahman, you have to be able to say, I am Ishwara, or you don't know what it means to say, I am Brahman. That's what it amounts to. Right? Because otherwise you're bypassing the jiva and Ishwara, so you just want to go it's almost like yoga, where you just want to resolve into Brahman and not deal with the creation. But that's not complete. That's not Vedanta.
It's not non-dual.
It's not non-dual. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it seems like there's a lot of training then to recognize Ishwara, to be able to say that.
Well, training, there's a lot of knowledge, there's a lot of understanding.
Which is a little bit different than just understanding that I am Brahman?
Well, I would say, to use the language correctly, it's different than just saying I am Atma. Because you can do Drisha Viveka and get to that place of differentiation between the conscious being that you are and the body, mind, sense organs that are objectified. But now this Atma, that Drisha, seer seeing, is not complete if you just stop there. Because now you have to point out, make positive assertion to the very nature of this Atma that is non-objectifiable. So how can one Atma be different from another Atma when there's nothing to divide the two? So the knowledge, the Drikdrisha takes you to the Atma, but then the Atma has to be unfolded. What are the repercussions? Once you get to the nature of the self, you know, that has repercussions. What does that mean then? Who am I then? I can't be limited by the body, mind, sense organs, and neither can you. I can't be limited by anything that's objectified. I can't even be limited by time or space. because it's subject-object relationship. So when I get rid of all of those things, then what differentiates me from you? Nothing. And so then the self becomes something which is non-divisible, and non-objectifiable. So now we have this one Brahman and the creation. So that's two. We have Brahman and the creation. So what is this creation? Does it have any substance, any being other than Brahman? So that there are many different prakriyas that have to fall, teaching methodologies that have to fall into place to make this vision complete.
Like in the Mandukya, he sort of resolves it by you're Brahman and also everything else is Brahman.
Yeah, that's Karya Karana.
Okay.
Yeah. Karya Karana resolves into Mithya, Satya Mithya. There can't be anything that's not Brahman.
Right.
Yeah.
So then the world's not a problem anymore.
It's not a problem anymore. Yeah. In fact, it's only Mithya. Because if everything's Brahman, then there's not any duality then.
It's the same as you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's nothing that's not you. Unless you're dealing, you know, you're responding from the standpoint of the upadi, and that's the ajnanam.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's not, I'm taking big leaps there.
Yeah,
so
it was reasonable.
Well,
Carol. I want to make a request, because those three talks that you gave on meditation before we started the Mandukya were so nice. And I was thinking, before you started the next text, if you could do something on meditation, maybe even just one class, it would be really great.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's okay.
I'll second that.
I still have, like, I give those talks to friends, and they really like them a lot. I think they're really helpful for people just learning how to do it. Even.
Are they up on the archive?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Oh.
There are three talks in meditation.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Do you remember?
I do a lot of the inner child stuff in there.
Do you remember that?
Of course. You know what's interesting is because I'm doing, like, when I go I just went to Norway, new students there. And when I went to Del Norte, all new students, except for a couple of us. So then I get to teach all of these things, because I know nobody knows this, right? So it's okay, so we should teach this, then we should teach this, because nobody's heard these things before that's useful for them to have. So I just kind of noticed all of this knowledge coming to the forefront of things that have to be told. But in our class, we've told many different times and that type of thing. So yeah, I can do something that's just devoted to meditation, and we just go through in depth some of the things, deeper understanding.
Well, that'd be fun.
Yeah, that'd be good.
If I say I want knowledge, or I want to get over ignorance, that's a punya, and it just creates suffering. I mean, that in itself.
No, say it, how they say that. It doesn't have anything to do with punya papa there, really.
But
say you say, I want,
right?
Yeah, you say it's a desire.
Right.
It's a raga.
Okay.
You say, I want self-knowledge, okay? That is a great raga. Okay. And it can have lots of suffering involved, because you get obstructions are coming and all of this, so it can cause a lot of pain. But we say that is the only benign desire. It's the only benign raga. And the reason for that is that it resolves all raga. But while it's there, and until that knowledge is complete, there is stress, and, you know, and am I going to be able to go to class, or will I be able to study in enough depth to really get this? Am I really going to know? And all these kind of worries and obstructions and all these kind of things come up, because you want it so badly, you know. I mean, at least I remember for myself, and they talk about it in the Shastra. They have a label it. So they know. It is a strong desire for a mumukshu, and so it has all of the problems of a desire, but it's a benign desire because it resolves all raga. See what I mean? All raga dvesha. But yeah, you have to suffer it along the way until you get it. at least it solves the problem in the end. That's
yeah. first time I ever heard teachings of non-duality at all, they were from somebody named Punja.
Punjaji.
Punjaji. And I came up with that question too, because I thought I was being, I thought I was being kind of a smarty pants when I said, because he kept saying, you know, about desires, and I said, but the desire for liberation is the desire, you know. And he was very poetic. He had a beautiful way of speaking sometimes. Uh-huh. And he said, I still remember the exact words. He said, the desire for liberation is the final desire, which consumes all other desires and finally consumes itself.
That's very nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's beautifully said.
So who said that?
Punjaji. I'm going to do this question by Hasa. How do we know that we don't create any new prarabdha karmas once we give up all dharma and the dharma by giving up the idea of the karta? How do we actually know that? We know that because that's what the Shastra says. In this sense, the very definition of prarabdha karma, okay? The definition of prarabdha karma is that with the karmas that are taking place in this particular life. So then you're saying, in this life, I'm just rephrasing it for you, Hasa. In this life, I'm continuing to do karmas. Those are called agami karmas. So that's true. The karta who is doing the karmas is accruing karmas. But the recognition is that I am a karta. And I always have been, and I always will be. And so for me, there is no karma. No matter what karmas are being done by the upadhi. So that's the way out of this. There is no way out of it from the standpoint of the jiva within the creation. The way out is the recognition that by nature I am a karta. I am free of all karma and I've never done any karma at all. So what is the most efficient way to get in touch with what is buried alive in us emotionally based on your experience and understanding at this point in time? To me, it's that inner dialogue. It's a paradigm shift, yeah. To me, it's the inner dialogue and following, being able to follow and be with your emotions. The emotions are like a route. They take you directly to the complexes. Usually, instead of us being with our emotions, dialoguing with them, asking what this is really about, usually the emotions are only related to what is happening outside, like this person hurt me or this person makes me happy and all of this kind of stuff. It's always projected out. Yeah. But and the happy ones we don't mind, but don't worry about those. It's the painful ones. The next time, every time that you have a painful emotion, an agitated emotion, you just go inside and be with that emotion, not projecting it, you just be with the emotion, and then you say, what's really going on? And you have to say it kindly, like if you say, what's really going on, or something like that, then everything just shuts down. But if you're kind, and you really ask and as a friend, and you want to help, then that emotion will tell you what it is and talk to you. And then you can spend time and really transform that, you know. So I think that's the best way. So you say, so it is the validation that opens the door. Validation in the sense of being present with it instead of projecting it. And yeah, validation in the sense that you're having that emotion and that emotion is telling you why you're having it, what it's really about. And you can remember back to when that happened and validate that yes, that did happen. And then you can say, and now things are different. I'm with you and you don't have to be so afraid now. Or the radical presence with it. The radical presence with it means your own kind presence is what allows for that transformation, but you also have to give it a chance to talk. To talk to you.
What's radical?
Just being totally, the presence of your own being with it. What if it hurts too much? If it really hurts too much, you can come back to it later. You can say, this is hurting me too much right now, and I'll come back later.
But you have to mean it.
You have to mean what you say. But you know what? Usually, it really doesn't hurt too much. If you can relax and welcome that, for if you become tense with the hurt, then it builds on itself, you know? But if you welcome the hurt, then there's something pleasurable in that pain. If you can welcome the hurt, means that the buddhi has some relaxation, then there's some pleasure in the pain, because there's a release that's taking place. But if, when the hurt is there, you're reacting to the hurt, then you can come back to it later, because you're reacting to the hurt and then making it worse. And so then you're spiraling down. So you have to be in a place to be able to welcome that hurt and be with it. Sometimes you can say something like, it's okay, you can be with me. Like, imagine a child who's really, really hurt. You know, you have to be able to be with that child in a soothing way in order for the child to calm down and to process it. But if you can't do that, then it's just going to escalate. So you don't want it to escalate. You say, I guess it just takes lots of practice. Yeah, you can say it like that. You just have to do it, start doing it. It doesn't take that much practice, but on the other hand, it becomes just the way you are. It becomes a way of life. You know? Because the more you do that, the more rewarding it is.
So that's a habit of knowledge, a habit of caring.
Yeah, once you do it a few times for yourself, your psyche appreciates it so much.
Yeah.
You know? It feels so grateful that somebody's paying attention and giving some love, you know. That then you want to do that more. It becomes easier and easier to do. Okay, everybody. Time to say good night.